Welcome to the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. If you're just a beginning gardener or you want good gardening information, well, you've come to the right spot. There's this persistent myth about putting rocks or broken pot shards in the bottom of plant containers before adding soil. Professor Linda Chalker Scott of Washington State University will tell you why that's a bad idea. She also blows away a few other gardening myths as well, such as the mistaken belief that you shouldn't water your plant's leaves on a hot afternoon because they might burn, and why adding sand to clay soil will not improve drainage. And we get to dive into a big pile of oak leaf mulch. Professor Debbie Flower will tell you why that's gardener's gold. Oh, it's blueberry season here, and we'll tell you why this sweet and tart taste treat just might be the cure for what ails you. It's all in episode 14 of Garden Basics with Farmer Fred, and we're going to do it all in under 30 minutes. Let's go. There's a couple of books that came out about a decade ago that are still sitting on my garden bookshelf, and they're excellent reference books. One is called The Informed Gardener, and the other is called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. They both explode a lot of garden myths, and they're written by Linda Chalker Scott.
Thank you, Fred. Glad to be here.
And Linda Chalker Scott works for Washington State University. She is a part of their horticulture department there. And as part of the WSU horticulture website, she has maintained over the years a list of so-called truths that have damaged both plant and environmental health. Things that you would think would be just common sense that you've heard for years, so they must be right. Well, as the title of a 1970 Fire Sign Theater album once proclaimed, everything you know is wrong. And it's certainly very true when it comes to horticulture. As things change, plant names change, chemicals change, research changes. Well, your book is certainly a compendium of information that is going to make people scratch their heads.
Or sometimes worse.
Yes. But just looking through the index, as far as the myths that you tackle, there are several that I have checkmarked that people may think, oh, that can't be true. But it is. And first off, you deal with the myth of drainage material in containers. And for years and years and years, we have heard about when planting in containers, put some gravel or some broken up shards of a pot at the bottom to improve drainage. And it always struck me that wouldn't that actually clog up the drainage holes? But you take it a step further and look at the flow of water involved.
You know, and Fred, I used to do the very same thing. In fact, many of these myths, if not all of them, were things that I used to do. And this is even when I was getting my PhD in horticulture. So it's not from lack of knowledge. It's just understanding a lot of these myths that I've just come across as being fact. And the drainage one is a really interesting one because intuitively it just makes sense, you know, to all of us. If you're thinking about water, you know, percolating through soil, that all of a sudden when it encompasses the pebbles or pot shards, it's going to flow faster. And actually what happens is that it stops flowing and starts moving horizontally through that same soil that it's already in and creates this perched water table.
And that would explain sometimes the white ring you might see around a ceramic pot.
Exactly.
But it's interesting that it actually inhibits the flow of water through the drainage holes.
And the reason is because water moves really readily through soil or materials that have about the same particle size and pore size. And once it encounters something that's a little bit smaller or bigger, then it stops. And it's not until you get a lot of gravitational force behind it that continues to move downwards.
And a lot of people complicate matters by having a few, if any, drain holes, and they're maybe too small. And then they put the pot straight on the ground, and that inhibits the outflow even more.
Oh, yeah.
So it's always a good idea to raise your containers off the ground by a quarter inch or a half inch or so on a plant stand or some container legs, just to allow some airflow beneath it and also to help keep those holes unplugged.
Right.
And so I guess the bottom line would be to whatever you fill the container with, be consistent.
Exactly. And it makes it a little bit tough, you know, when you get down to those drain holes, if you're using some kind of potting media that is going to run through the draining holes. And what I've found is if you just take just a little piece of newspaper or tissue paper, something that's going to break down pretty quickly, and just to temporarily cover that hole, it'll hold the soil in, and then by the time the paper breaks down, you know, the soil is not going to be moving through there anymore.
Another myth that you explode in your book, The Informed Gardener, has to do with landscape fabric. And for years and years and years, a lot of us used landscape fabric because, it allows air and water to flow through. So just put down this plastic-like material and cover it with mulch, and you'll never have any weeds again.
Well, and you know, it does have its purposes as a temporary barrier. In fact, I think that using it between rows in your vegetable garden is a great way to keep that area, you know, weed-free. But the problem is that those holes that are in those fabrics stay clear for about a day, and then they start filling up with, you know, bits of soil and other materials, and then you're restricting constantly the movement of water and air through that fabric. Plus, it doesn't stop weeds from growing, as you've probably seen in older landscapes where there's been fabric down for a while. You know, dirt starts to settle on top of it, weed seeds blow in, and then you have a nice crop of weeds growing right on top of your fabric.
And a lot of times, too, you'll see those weeds, and you'll go to yank them out, and you bring up half the landscape fabric with it.
Do you have time for a little story? Anecdotal story. When we moved into the house we have right now, I'd gone out to work a new bed, put some perennials in, and I kept on hitting something hard about 6 inches below the surface of the soil. Finally dug it all up, and it was fabric that the previous owners had put down to keep the weeds out. And it was just completely colonized with bindweed and with horsetail. It was just a mess. And so it obviously wasn't keeping them out at all, but it was really inhibiting water movement, earthworm movement. You know, anything that needs to go up and down in the soil gets really bound up by these fabrics.
One thing I have noticed in areas where I have put down a landscape fabric and then went to remove it, when I removed it, roots from nearby shrubs were close to the surface.
Well, yeah, and that's partially because they'll grow through, you know, where you have seams of the fabric coming together. You know, they'll find those breaks and grow through them. And more damaging is when you do pull those fabrics up, then you're yanking up all those fine feeder roots from your trees and shrubs.
The option then is what?
Well, the option obviously is not to use them in the first place. But if you do have them down and you want to remove them and use something that's a little bit more root-friendly, I would certainly not be removing it in the summer when you're really going to be having a lot of water stress anyway. You know, wait till wintertime when trees have gone dormant and you can remove those fabrics and replace them with a different kind of mulch.
Yeah, and that's the key, isn't it, putting down an organic mulch?
Exactly.
And that can be maybe wood chips or your own trees chipped and shredded. Sometimes it's a good idea to invest in a chipper shredder rather than a rototiller, because with a chipper shredder, you can take those fallen tree limbs or prunings and make a really nice mulch, and you're not importing somebody else's problems into your yard with their chipped wood.
You know, I keep on saying that's what I want for Christmas, is my very own shredder, for that very, very reason, because I would love to be able to use, you know, the downed limbs and other cuttings and shred them up and use them on my own landscape. Barring that, I do use arborist wood chips for the very same reason, although I don't know where they come from. At least they're local, and it's keeping them out of the landfill, and they make a really great organic mulch for a landscape.
Do you let them age before you use them?
I personally don't. I've never had a problem, and sometimes with some of the work that I was doing with students, we didn't really have the luxury of letting them sit. We had to use them right away. And actually, I love them because they smell so great when they're fresh, and I really like working with them then. A lot of the concerns with wood chips in terms of, would they have, you know, if you have diseased woods chipped up, is that going to be a problem? Research has shown that no, we don't transmit disease from diseased wood down through many inches of mulch down to roots. And I always caution people, you know, if you're concerned about pests or pathogens, by all means, let them sit on site for a while and compost. But I've seen no damage from anything using fresh chips.
And being a lazy kind of gardener, I really like your advice when it comes to using wood chips as a mulch, as far as you have to take the weeds or get the weeds down before you put the mulch on, obviously. But what I like is you say to prune or mow the perennial weeds at the root crown, because pulling them out destroys the soil structure.
Exactly. And you're just like me. I'm also a lazy gardener and a cheap gardener. So anything I can do to save myself some labor, I do. Yeah, and if you wait until things are really starting to go dormant anyway, and then you're mowing them down, they have less of a chance of coming back.
For years, we have heard some rather unsound advice. If you have clay soil, add sand to improve its texture. But it seems to me that's a recipe for making bricks.
That's That's exactly right. That's how you make concrete, isn't it?
Yeah. How did that ever start?
It's partially because of what the perfect soil consists of. And if you look at a soil triangle, you know, the ideal loamy soils are a certain mixture of sand and clay and silt. And that's what makes a perfect loam. And so if somebody has a landscape that maybe isn't as perfect, you know, they're thinking, well, the easiest way to solve that is to add, you know, what they're missing. But unfortunately, most of us don't know exactly how much we would need. And the problem is, especially with a clay soil, that you have to add about 50% more volume of sand just to get that to a more sandy texture. If you add just a little bit of sand, it creates, as you say, adobe. And so you'd have to just add an awful lot of sand to really change the texture. And then the problem is that, you know, you may understand the boundaries of your property, but your trees and shrubs' roots don't. And they'll continue to grow outside your boundary. And if you've changed the texture, you know, dramatically from what the surrounding soil is like, you're going to, again, have a problem with water movement, air movement, and root movement.
We see that a lot with people who will dig a hole to plant a tree or a shrub, and instead of using their native soil, they'll go out and buy some premium potting soil and throw that in the hole and plant their tree or shrub in that. But as you just pointed out, what happens is the surrounding water will flow into that nice, loose soil, and it's like a constantly flooded zone.
Exactly, and it dries out faster too. So in the summer, when you've got the drier time of year, you're going to have that area evaporating water faster, and the surrounding soil doesn't. So the roots are exposed either to constant drought or constant flooding. And it's not a great way to get your plants established.
In your book, The Informed Gardener, you also tackle another myth, and it's one that I can't believe is still around, yet people will buy vitamin B1. And for you talk to anybody, and you know they'll describe how they put in a new tree or a shrub or a plant, and they say, oh, yeah, and I added vitamin B1 to reduce transplant shock.
Right. Well, that's what marketing will do for you, and
yeah.
Especially when we tend to think of things in the context of what we do for ourselves. And you know, if we take vitamin supplements, many of us do take vitamin B supplements, and so you just kind of extrapolate that and think, well, it must be good for the plants, too. And what people don't realize is that plants make their own. So they certainly don't need us to add that. It's just an extra cost and waste of resources to add those kinds of fertilizers to plants.
And it isn't the vitamin B1 in that bottle that's probably doing your plant any good. There's small amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and perhaps some micronutrients that are the real keys to that.
Right, and sometimes there's also a hormone, usually an auxin. It might be IAA or NAA or something like that. And those actually do have a stimulatory effect on rooting. So that type of rooting hormone or transplant hormone actually does do some good. And so those mixtures of transplant elixirs, if they happen to have a little bit of that hormone, they will have an effect, but certainly not the B1 that does it.
Right, exactly. So if you think thiamine is going to help reduce transplant shock, I can save you a lot of money. Just go to the grocery store, buy some vitamin B1, the generic brand, and throw a tablet in the... If you pick up a copy of The Informed Gardener, you're going to find all sorts of exploded myths, the myth of wound dressings. We talked about we didn't talk about hot weather watering, but briefly it talks about there really is no damage to a plant if you water your plant on a hot afternoon, is there?
As long as you're not using salt water, there's absolutely no damage, and you're just going to reduce the shock to it of being drought-stressed. What usually happens is when people do water, they're watering when they sing wilt, and then, of course, those leaves have been fatally wilted. They're going to develop brown edges, and so people tend to blame the watering rather than the lack of water for that brown development, but it's not the water that's burning the leaves.
And it's what I like is a lot of your solutions, apply mulch.
That's right.
I like that.
Yep, I do too. You know, a decent, healthy soil, you're going to have decent, healthy roots and a decent, healthy plant.
Linda Jocker-Scott, author of two great books, The Informed Gardener and The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. Thanks for a few minutes of your time.
Well, thanks, Fred. I enjoyed it.
Here on the Garden Basics podcast, we want to answer your garden questions. A couple of ways you can do that. Give us a call, 916-292-8964. That number again, 916-292-8964. 8964. You can either leave a message or you can text that number as well. Be patient. There are a lot of rings before we pick up. Another way is email. Send your garden questions to fred@farmerfred.com. That's fred@farmerfred.com. One benefit of email is you can attach a photo of a bug or a plant that you're trying to identify. We're looking forward to hearing and seeing your questions. And thanks for listening to the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. I appreciate all your support and all your comments. We like to answer your garden questions here on the Garden Basics podcast. I like to bring in Debbie Flower to help answer them. Debbie Flower, a retired horticultural professor, has gardened and taught horticulture throughout the United States. And Debbie, we got a question here from Carol, who says she lives on a ranch and has access to naturally composted oak leaves. And she's, yeah, lucky her. She says, yeah. Do I mix it in with soil or do I just use it as a mulch around the garden and landscape plants?
She's lucky. Boy, it should be used as a mulch. Mixing in is called amending the soil. And there are specific things you can buy as soil amendments or add as soil amendments, but oak leaves is not one of them. Many things that we use as mulch, straw, arborist chips, sometimes we use bark chips in our ornamental garden, or leaves, should just be laid on top and used as mulch. We don't want to till them in or turn them in with a shovel. We don't want to amend the soil with them. We just want to leave them on top. They'll break down naturally.
Yeah, I guess it really depends on the weather, wherever you might happen to be. Let's get into that in a second. But first, I think we should talk about the benefits of oak leaf mulch. Man, oh, man, that is such good stuff.
It sure is. It sure is. Benefits of mulch in general are many. They protect the soil surface from, believe it or not, water droplets can cause soil compaction. They can hit the soil. They hit the soil so hard. If you've ever seen a time-lapse photography of a drop of water hitting soil, boy, it just creates this huge puff of soil coming up around it. So it can prevent the soil from compacting due to water droplets. It can moderates the temperature. You cannot prevent freezing or really hot soil with mulch, but it moderates the temperature. The change in temperature will happen more slowly, and plants can adapt better to that. It slows down the loss of moisture, and it allows the water that's coming in from rain or from overhead irrigation to trickle into the soil, and so it preserves the soil structure. And it breaks down. If it's an organic mulch like we're talking about, oak leaves, it breaks down and improves the quality of the soil.
Yeah, it feeds the soil. It's like a natural fertilizer.
Yes. Commercial people who, I'm thinking tree, fruit, or nuts, who only use mulch to fertilize their plants.
And because it's there year-round, it's slowly feeding the soil consistently.
Yes.
As we have talked about on this show, the other big benefit of mulch is it helps control weeds, too. And you were telling me that when you lived in Portland, Oregon, you were able to get a steady supply of oak leaf mulch. And you put it on how thickly in your yard?
Well, it was mixed mulch. It wasn't just oak leaves. Portland, city of Portland, this was a long time ago, but the city of Portland collected homeowner green waste at the curb. And you could leave big piles, and I collected it. I had a small city lot, and I moved. I got a big delivery and moved it wheelbarrow load by wheelbarrow load up a hill, both ways, of course, to my backyard and dumped it there and spread it. It was 2 feet deep. And then the next spring, when I went out, it was almost completely gone. So it had broken down. It had decomposed and made my soil so rich, and there were so many earthworms. It was just amazing how many earthworms were there and how dark and rich the soil was. And I had such a wonderful garden that year.
I can vouch for that, too. I've been putting down chipped and shredded tree branches on my property here for the last 4 years, and whenever I'm digging into it, I am finding more worms than I've ever seen before.
Yes, and we like worms because they keep paths open in the soil that allow water to move through the soil and oxygen to move through the soil, and that makes for good root growth, regardless of what we're growing. But some people, the vegetable garden has some, there are some things I would not use as mulch in the vegetable garden. And one would be bark, which you can buy in a bag. I would not use that as mulch because it breaks down incredibly slowly, and it can cause, if some of it gets buried, some of the bark gets buried into the soil, it can cause a nitrogen deficiency. Sawdust would be more likely to cause a nitrogen deficiency because it's carbon, and it actually breaks down very quickly, and nitrogen is needed for that breakdown process. Something like leaves I would use, they have a nice carbon nitrogen ratio, and that's a sort of a technical thing about composting. Oak leaves break down more slowly than other leaves, but that's fine. But you can speed that process up by shredding them.
Right. And you can use your lawnmower, or what I like to do is get my neighbor's pin oak leaves, put them in a metal trash can, and put my string trimmer down into it and chop up those leaves a little bit more, and then put them on my raised beds in November and just let them sit there on top all the way through spring.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. People sometimes worry that oak leaves are not a good choice as a mulch because they are high in something called tannins. They do have tannins in them, and they do slow down the breakdown of the oak leaves, but it is not a problem for other plants in the garden. And people also wonder if oak leaves will cause the soil to become too acidic, will lower the pH, will change the chemical balance in the soil. But that, again, that will not happen. So oak leaves are a good choice in the vegetable garden and in the ornamental garden as a mulch.
And you can put it on, I guess, about as thick as you like.
Yes. As always, you want to keep that mulch away from the bases of in particular woody plants, but all plants. Leave some oxygen space around between the base of that plant and the mulch. But you can use it for pretty much anything.
Yeah, I've often wondered about that as well. Because we talk about that a lot, it's not piling mulch up against the trunks of trees, for example, which is not a good thing to do. But I'm wondering how far away from the trunk it should actually be. Should the crown area, which don't ask me why, but the crown area of the tree is actually the part where the roots meet the trunk, down on the ground. It's not up in the top of the tree. It's at the bottom of the tree. Should you keep the crown area clear as well?
There's some debate. I've been reading about that recently, but the generally accepted method is to keep the crown area bare. It's where you can see root flare. So when a trunk goes into the ground, it shouldn't look like a telephone pole going into the soil. It should fan out, become bigger as it above the soil before it disappears into the ground. And so, yes, we want to keep that part exposed. We don't want to put mulch on it.
All right. So if you see that root area exposed on the top of your soil, attached to your tree there, don't mulch on top of that. Keep the mulch a few inches away.
Right. We're only talking inches from the trunk. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then give it a chance to breathe, really.
Yes.
You know,
you don't want to trap moisture. Mulch can trap moisture against bark, and that can cause rot in the trunk of the tree. And we're trying not to cause that to happen.
And one more note about sawdust. I get that question a lot, too, of people who want to use sawdust in the garden as a mulch. And sawdust has a lot of problems, not the least of which, if you're using it as a mulch, because it is such a fine product, it could create an anaerobic environment. And I'll let you explain what I just said, because I just use big words.
Anaerobic means without air. And the other thing that comes to mind for me that will cause an anaerobic environment is a thick layer of newly cut grass.
Mm.
And it's not quite as small as sawdust in some dimensions, but in other dimensions it is. And so the organic material, either the sawdust or the grass blades, lay down so close to each other that there's no space in between them for air. And over time, it just gets tighter and tighter, and it creates an almost impenetrable layer on the soil. And so neither air nor water can get through them. And it will hit that layer and slide off to the side. And roots need both water and oxygen to live. And if they don't get one or the other of them, then they will not live. And if they're not living, the plant isn't living. So we need to sawdust is a potentially great product for the garden, but it must be composted or mixed in with other compost.
And you made a good point, too, about the drawbacks of using your lawn cuttings as mulch. If anybody's ever piled up wet grass after just cutting it and you go back to it a couple of days later, you notice how matted it is. And that was what would happen if you put it from the mower straight to your garden as a mulch. It would form a mat. And I've heard some people get around that who want to use the lawn trimmings as a mulch by spreading those lawn cuttings out on a asphalt or a concrete area first and leaving it there for a few days to let it dry out a bit first.
Yes, or laying very, very thin layers one day, come back to next day that first layer is dry, and laying another layer on top so you can see between the blades. They shouldn't be so thick that they completely cover the soil each day. That to me sounds real tedious. I would rather mix it in with other things or put it straight in a compost pile and then move it.
Well, once again, we have taken the scenic bypass the long way here in the question and answer session of finding out if oak leaf mulch is a good mulch. And yes, it is. And so that's the short answer. You've heard the long answer. Debbie Flower, thanks for a lot of minutes of your time in answering all these garden questions here on the Garden Basics Podcast.
I love all these trips we take in the gardening world together, Fred. Thank you.
Here's a quick tip for you. It's perfectly okay to plant trees in the summertime. The only time not recommended for planting is in wet, cold soil during the winter rainy season. Roots actually grow quickly in the summertime because of higher soil temperatures. But don't add fertilizer during the first year. Let the plant get established on its own. However, do add several inches of mulch to the top to keep the soil cooler, and that also helps to retain soil moisture. This is one of my favorite times of the year because it's blueberry harvest season. I love blueberries, and they're easy to grow. They are a big part of growing and eating heart-healthy fruits and vegetables loaded with fiber. Most people are familiar with fiber. Fiber is a component of all plant-based foods which can't be absorbed or digested. It travels relatively intact through your body and then out. That's the role of insoluble fiber, the roughage found in many fruits, vegetables, and grains that passes through your digestive system and helps promote regularity. But there's another type of fiber. It's called soluble fiber. It's a type of fiber that dissolves in water to form a gel-like material. Studies at the Mayo Clinic and other institutions have shown that soluble fiber may help lower blood cholesterol levels by reducing the bad cholesterol, the low-density lipoproteins. Soluble fiber may have other heart-healthy benefits as well, such as lowering blood pressure, lowering blood glucose levels, very important for type 2 diabetes patients, and it reduces inflammation as well. And blueberries are one of the top five fruits and vegetables with the most soluble fiber that you can grow in your backyard. The others are artichokes, shell beans, apricots, and green peas. But blueberries have so many uses in the kitchen. They have about 3 grams of soluble fiber per 100 grams, and just about every part of the country can grow some sort of variety of blueberries. The northern tier states love the northern highbush blueberry varieties. Down south, they have the rabbit eye blueberries. Here on the west coast, the southern highbush blueberry varieties have a low chill requirement and are heat tolerant, and you can plant a succession of them to get a continual harvest for 3 or 4 months. One of the favorites I'm eating right now is called Emerald. It's a large, tasty blueberry. Other varieties that we've had success here in California, Sharp Blue, Jubilee, South Moon, Blue Ray, Sunshine Blue, and Misty. But there's plenty more. It's tasty, it's healthy, it's blueberries. Plant some soon. If you want directions on how to do it, go back to episode 2 of the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. We talk about how to grow blueberries. And here's the secret. Do it in containers. To your health. Thank you for listening to the Garden Basics with Farmer Fred podcast. I appreciate your ears. How about a subscription? You can get the podcast wherever podcasts are given away, such as Apple, Spotify, Google, iHeart, Stitcher, and many more.